From Sacramento, the Bishop's Radio Hour with Bob Dunning on Relevant Radio, focusing on today's issues in the context of gospel values. Now, here's Bob.
That's me. Welcome to you on this beautiful day the Lord has made. Indeed, it is a beautiful day. Appreciate you all being with us on the Bishop's Hour as we launch our 22nd year on the air, and appreciate everyone who helped us along the way, all our underwriters, all our listeners out there, and of course, all the thousands of guests we've had over those years, including our friend Rex Rolanka, the director of music at the Cathedral of the Blessed Sacrament. Rex, good day to you.
Hey, good to be here with you again.
And also a professor at Jesuit High School.
Yeah.
What do you teach at Jesuit?
I teach three choirs. I teach men's chorus, which is our beginning choir, comprised mainly of freshmen. And I teach chamber singers, which is the advanced audition choir. And I also do what we call liturgy workshop, which is the choir that sings for the masses on campus.
Oh, very good. Is singing allowed these days?
Technically not.
Yeah.
Definitely not indoors.
Mm-hmm.
And the bishop's guidelines for singing in church right now is the only persons who may sing are the priest and the cantor.
Mm-hmm. And they must have good voices.
Well, we hope. That should be a prerequisite.
That should be, yes. You do not want me singing solo, Rex.
I'd audition you for the choir.
Would you?
At the cathedral.
Yeah, but would I get past the audition stage?
I'm very nice.
Well, Bob, we've decided to go a different direction. You are really very good, but yeah.
You could be our announcer.
Okay, that would be good. I would enjoy that. I would definitely enjoy that. That would be a complete honor. So tell us what it entails being the director of music at the Cathedral of the Blessed Sacrament. I mean, with all the tourists walking in the middle of Mass.
Yeah, well, now there's no tourists.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of weird to be inside the cathedral in the middle of the afternoon, and we're just completely shut down. During a normal year, I'd be preparing for my choir rehearsal. The choir normally rehearses on Wednesday evenings, and we do a lot of sacred repertoire. That's not your typical parish music, because we do present a lot of choral music, stuff that maybe some people would consider academic-type music, music that is definitely not congregational singing, but I believe that it's music that enhances our prayer and our liturgy. And then we have a lot of weddings at the cathedral. I believe that one year we had over 100, so there was a lot of playing of weddings and meeting with those brides and grooms, which is quite a pleasure to meet these young couples who are just so excited for their future.
So you're helping them plan the music. Are you providing musicians and possibly singers?
Yes. Definitely. Mm-hmm. So they have the option of a cantor with an organist. That's already provided for their liturgy. And then if they want to splurge, we've had string quartets, brass quartets, me with a harpist or a harp and flute. So it really is up to the couple as to how elaborate they want to go. And we've had couples hired the cathedral choir.
Hmm. So because it is a sacred place and a sacred space, but it is their wedding, are there restrictions on, I mean, can they play Going to the Chapel? I mean, can they do that? Or
they try.
They try, yeah. This is our favorite song.
Yeah, I know, and I do get a lot of that. And I just tell them that especially here at the cathedral, which is considered the mother church of our diocese,
right,
that the music should be of a sacred quality. If they ask for vocal music, I tend to rely on the hymnal.
Mm-hmm.
And I say most of the music that we would provide should be out of the hymnal.
I don't know why you would want to get married in the cathedral and not have that kind of music.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we get a huge, maybe over 50% of the couples that come here actually don't attend a cathedral. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a beautiful church, so
sure.
In a way it's kind of like Carmel Mission. You know, it's a tourist.
Yeah. Yep.
It's a destination church.
Yeah. Oh, indeed. Indeed. Mm-hmm. And so, do you still play Here Comes the Bride?
I do.
Okay. All right. That one's okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
It's on the organ.
Yeah, right. So you have so many masses, though, at the cathedral just on a Sunday. Is there a choir for each mass? How does that work?
So there's the primary cathedral choir, which normally sing, well, before we changed our mass times due to COVID, mm-hmm. they sing at the 11 a.m.
Right.
mass. And that's the one English choir. There's also two Spanish choirs, one that sang at the 1 p.m. and the 7 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
Now, because of COVID, our schedule has been pulled back quite a bit. So actually, the only masses we have are 8 a.m. and 10 a.m. in English,
mm-hmm.
and then noon in Spanish and 2 o'clock in Chinese.
Now, are those outdoors or are they in the building?
We're back in the building.
Okay.
Yep.
With limited capacity.
Yeah, we're limiting it to 100, and then I believe we have overflow seating for 50 in the basement.
Okay, so the cathedral seats, what, 1,800 or so?
I would say more like 1,200, but
uh-huh.
the plaque in the back, the fireman's plaque says, I think, 1,400, you know, so that's
max,
standing room
yeah.
only.
Yeah. Yeah, and you stream it down to the basement,
yeah.
to Mercy Hall.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because last weekend, it's, sounded like there's about a 30-second delay. So when it was quiet in the church, we could hear ourselves 30 minutes ago, 30 seconds ago.
I remember once getting asked to MC something that the choir, I believe, was putting on.
Yeah.
And I said, what? This sounds, it's in the cathedral? And they said, no, it's downstairs. And I said, I didn't even know there was a downstairs.
Yeah.
And yeah, a whole another building down there.
Yeah, they remodeled that when we remodeled the entire cathedral back in 2005.
Okay.
Yeah, so yeah, it was nice to finally have a nice gathering space for the cathedral parish.
Well, Rex, this sounds as if it's something you went to college for. It sounds like something this is just fits you to a T, the way you've lived your life.
Yeah, just music has been part of my life ever since I was a little kid, so... I think the primary thing that grabbed me about church music was the service to the church. I was always, as a youngster, volunteering at like Loaves and Fishes or the
mm-hmm.
local elderly home.
Sure.
And then actually after college, I volunteered for a year with the Dominican Volunteers in Chicago, working with people with AIDS at Bonaventure House, which
mm-hmm.
is run by a group of brothers called
right.
the Alexian Brothers. And then to have music, I just thought, wow, what a great way to utilize my love for service to people with my passion, which is music. So whenever I'm ministering at church, I feel like I'm serving the people of God.
And you went to that great Catholic shrine, Notre Dame?
Yeah, Catholic Disneyland.
Catholic Disneyland,
yep.
including the grotto.
Yeah, yeah. The whole experience.
I'm afraid I'm going to see a Saturday Night Live skit about Notre Dame. Yeah, I remember going back there to cover a game, and and I had the whole Notre Dame experience. I was sitting in the press box, got to interview on the radio Father Jenkins,
wow.
and then... you know, went for a walk around the campus, went to the grotto, went to the bookstore, came back, and the press box is like on the sixth floor of the, you know, so you have to take the elevator.
Yeah.
Elevator opens, and who's on the elevator? Joe Montana.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm going,
wow.
This is like, you're right, it was Catholic Disneyland.
That's amazing. Yeah, when I was a student there, I believe I was a junior, and they had just done the very first remodel or expansion of that stadium.
It went from I know that it went from 58,888, because I would read that in the paper every Sunday morning. Yeah. What was the attendance? And they just said that's what it was because it was full. And it went from that to 80,000, but they kept the facade, I think.
Yes, yeah. And then they just added a bowl above it. And it was amazing because I remember one of our pep rallies before, the evening before a game, it was inside that new stadium. And Joe Montana came, and it was the first time he had been on campus, supposedly, since he graduated.
Wow.
Yeah, that was special.
A lot of lore there, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, you brought a lot of music with you today.
Yes.
And I'll let you lead the band because I'm in way over my head.
So what we were doing was basically doing a quick survey of sacred music. And what I did last time was look at it from the lens of the Requiem Mass, and I wanted to continue that. So last time we looked at the Gregorian chant Requiem Mass.
Right.
So we're looking about the Middle Ages, so, you know, 800 to 1200-ish. And so we're fast-forwarding to the Renaissance, which is one of the major stylistic periods of Western music. And the mass I wanted to preview today was the Requiem Mass by Tomás Luis de Victoria, who was a Spanish composer. He was very active around Ávila. I believe he actually did music in the cathedral in Ávila. And he was a priest, and he went and studied in Rome, but then went back home to do more music there.
And you're saying this would be around 800. I could just see one of my teenagers saying, did they call it the Middle Ages in the Middle Ages?
Or the Dark Ages.
Yeah.
The Dark Ages,
did they call World War One World War One during World War One?
Yeah.
You know, you're like, I don't know.
Well, this guy, he was actually, his dates are actually 1550 to 1611. So definitely in the Renaissance era, and actually paralleling kind of the Counter-Reformation.
Yeah.
So what's going on in music during this time is they're really going back to Gregorian chant and using Gregorian chant as the basis for their music, because Gregorian chant is kind of like almost the ideal for liturgical music. And it's kind of, even if you look at the liturgical documents today, it still kind of holds Gregorian chant in very high esteem. So music is still Latin. It's sung by a very trained choir. I mean, this is music that your congregation can't sing, which is very interesting because at the very same time you have Martin Luther, who's starting this kind of religious revolution in Germany, and they're bringing in, probably for the first time since the early Christian church, music to be sung by your average churchgoer.
Like me.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So hymnody is happening, whereas at the same time, the Catholic Church is continuing on this path of very refined, very complex music for choirs. And the Catholic Church will continue to do that all up until Vatican II. So anyway, so Tomás Luis de Victoria, he is considered one of possibly the most passionate composer of his time. So I thought we could cue up maybe track 8. And this is the introit for his Requiem Mass. And what is very interesting about this is that he quotes the Gregorian chant. He quotes the Gregorian chant that we played last time I was on the air. And what's of note is that he quotes the entire Gregorian chant, but he elongates the entire melody.
Wow.
So let's go ahead and cue up track 8, and this is Requiem Aeternam.
Very good.
Introit by Victoria.
That's beautiful stuff.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I guess slapped myself awake. I'm gonna put headphones on and take that to bed with me.
Yeah. Right.
Oh man.
it'll provide a very restful.
Oh.
Very very restful sleep. great way to pray actually before you go to bed.
Oh, exactly. That is beautiful stuff.
Yeah. So what's really cool, I find. So what he does is he takes the Gregorian chant, which literally it would take you less than a minute to sing, and he's elongated it. And if you listen closely, and it's actually easier to see it if you read the music, to see him place that Gregorian chant in long notes, and you could hear it actually in the uppermost part of the music. You hear someone singing these long notes above these other voices, which are just meandering around beautifully with a lot of motion.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's just this rock-solid Gregorian chant melody hovering above all of it. And I think we could hear that maybe even more distinctly if we played track 12, because now this is the Sanctus, and we played that last time. The Sanctus is perhaps one of the most well-known Gregorian chants. It's the one that goes, Sanctus, Sanctus, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So he takes that melody and, again, just throws it in the top soprano voice and elongates it. So maybe we could play about a minute of track 12?
Very good. How many voices are we hearing there?
We're hearing four. So we have a soprano. alto, a tenor, and a bass.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And what I find beautiful about when you study the history of music, you know, it starts off in the Western world with Gregorian chant with just one singing line. And then what they do later on is they add one other voice, and that's what we call a drone. So what they would do is someone would just sing one note below this melody. It's kind of like a bagpipe. You know, when mm-hmm. when someone hits that bagpipe, you just hear this note that continually sustains on the bottom. And then church music evolves into like the canon. So if for layman's terms, something like row your boat, where, you know, one person starts and then like four beats later another person starts.
Mm-hmm.
And so now they've taken that canon form and made it polyphony. So many voices, that's what polyphony means. And so now we have four voices just interweaving all these musical lines together. And what's fascinating about these composers is that they just kind of figured out how to make all these voices sound good.
You know, you look at that. You look at that word polyphony, and if you just saw the word, just the letters, and didn't hear anybody pronounce it, you'd think it was a phone ad. For you'll get multiple phones for the same low price.
Yes.
It's polyphony.
Yep. Latin.
Yes.
Or the Greek. I don't remember.
I'm not sure. Yeah. Oh, I yeah. So polyphony means many or yes. several or
yeah. So actually, one of the most popular pieces from this era was by a composer named Thomas Tallis from England, and he wrote a song that had 40 independent voices.
Hmm. Wow!
And it's just fascinating to look at the score. I mean, it's huge.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And how these people can conceive, you know, have composed that and just thought of it in their brain, you know, that's a God-given talent, right?
Yeah. Have you ever composed anything?
Little ditties.
I can't even imagine, you know, I can't even imagine that. I've, you know, listened to music all my life, and
mm-hmm.
and I go, where'd they get that melody, that tune, how did they conceive of that? And I always figure we've had music for so long that every possible combination of notes and et cetera has already happened, but it hasn't.
It hasn't, but you might not want to hear those combination of notes.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
You know, it's kind of interesting that you talk about where these people come up with it. I was at school today. We're in hybrid mode, and just sitting in the office, and there was a kid on the piano, and literally he was just playing what popped in his head.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was just improvising, and it's just, like I said, I think that's really a God-given talent to be able to just create this music without any, you know, previous thought about it. Just do it. You know, and I think that's what a lot of these guys did. You know, they took a pencil and had paper and then just started writing down music.
That's mind-boggling to me. When I was in the third grade at West Davis Elementary School, they had a guy, Mr. Draper, and he had this old school bus, and he'd go from school to school, and you'd actually have your little lesson with him in the bus, you know, because they didn't have a classroom for him. And I started on the drums, and after about 2 weeks, he says, let's try a musical instrument. So we did the trombone, and I'm sure that was really painful for him. And then after about 2 weeks, he said, let's try a string instrument. So we tried the violin.
Oh, my gosh.
And then the bus stopped coming. That was it.
Yeah, that's probably kind of painful.
Yeah.
You know, but the thing about music is at the beginning, it is kind of painful. I mean, you get,
yeah.
But once you get down those basics, gosh, I mean, it's sky's the limit, really.
So I know it's a little off topic, but how many different, I mean, truly different, distinct musical instruments are there?
Oh, I don't know. hundreds, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's...
You know, I think during the Romantic era, we're looking at the 1800s, which is kind of like the height of, like, the humongous orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
Composers like Mahler and Bruckner and Wagner, they were really writing for these large orchestras. And even Mahler, I think, he invented several instruments just to add to the orchestra because he wanted a particular sound.
So if we recorded those people back then with the instruments they had, like in 1600 and et cetera, would people listen to that today?
You know, there is what we call historical performance practice.
Mm-hmm.
So people actually try to mimic... Like me, I love on the organ listening to organs that would have been, built in like the 1700s,
mm-hmm.
you know, and hearing Bach performed on those
yeah.
instruments, because you get a closer feel for how the composer would have heard that music.
Exactly.
Now the issue with singing is that we don't have those instruments today. We don't have those voices, so we actually don't know what they would have sung.
Mm-hmm.
How they would have sung. I think we have a good idea that they would have tried to make beautiful tones, but
sure.
you know, through the centuries, beauty, the idea of beauty and aesthetics change.
Sure.
So, you know, instruments we can recreate, but the human voice, not so much.
Yeah, very interesting. Very interesting. Yeah. So, what else do you have?
So, we were looking at the Requiem, and I thought that, especially since as we're coming upon the November. The month where we pray and honor our dead.
Mm-hmm.
Let's look at a couple more songs. We'll listen to the Agnus Dei again. Very common Gregorian chant. That is track 14, and it starts with the Agnus Dei,
mm-hmm.
and then again the composer just elongates that melody into this, 2 to 3 minute piece. But let's just listen to 1 minute of Agnus Dei by Victoria, track 13.
Track 13. Very good. Good. Yeah. Very familiar.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What sublime music, really.
Yeah.
I feel like my heart rate just slowed down.
I know. It's amazing what it can do. You know, it's just about better than any medication I can think of.
Yeah. It reminds me of Pope Pius X, he was around 1900,
mm-hmm.
and he made one of the most popular treatises on sacred music. And what he said about sacred music was that the purpose of it was the glory of God and the sanctification and edification of the faithful.
Wow, that says it all.
That says it all, yeah.
Reader's Digest, 25 words or less.
Exactly, right?
Yeah.
What more do you need
yeah.
to know about sacred music than that?
Yeah.
For the greater glory of God.
Yeah.
And the sanctification, edification of the faithful.
Boy, I'm sure that you have those words in your mind as you're preparing for Sunday morning.
Oh, yes, definitely. Yep. I always say a little prayer that may this music allow the people to be closer mm-hmm. to our Lord.
Yeah, that's a good prayer. That's a good prayer. You got one more for us? I think we
yes.
have time.
So as we end October, the month of Mary, one of the most beautiful songs and texts of the church is the Ave Maria. And so Victoria composed one of the most popular Ave Marias of his time, and that is track 35 and 36.
Rex, I think we need to have you on every day.
I'd love to be on every day. I love music, and I love sharing it with people.
Yeah, well, you're sharing it great today, and I can't thank you enough. And as we move into, as you say, this, I was talking to Bishop Soto earlier, and I said, you know, there's two great days coming up. But I'm not talking about Halloween and Election Day. I'm talking about the 2 days they're sandwiched right between Halloween and Election Day, All Saints Day and All Souls Day.
Yep, and my favorite feast day besides Christmas and Easter is All Saints Day. And
yep.
My anniversary here at the cathedral is November 1, 2005.
Oh. Wow.
So I will always forever remember November 1.
So this will be number 15.
Number 15.
What
years,
did we get for number 15? Is I think that's balsa wood.
Okay, that's better than paper.
Rex, always great. Do you want to? Is there one more we can just play out to break here?
Sure. Let's play track 14, which is Lux Aeterna, which
Good.
Is the communion song for the Mass for the Dead by Victoria. And it's always a pleasure to be here with you, Bob.
Thanks, Rex. God bless.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you.
We'd like to thank all the wonderful people and organizations, businesses in town and throughout the Diocese of Sacramento who have provided underwriting for the Bishop's Hour, some in the last few years, some have been with us for a very long time. If you would like to be an underwriter for the Bishop's Radio Hour, it's a wonderful opportunity to support this mission and also to support the diocese and also to get some recognition for your organization or for your business. The easiest way to do this is to give us a shout, send us an email, radio@scd.org, and we can give you all the details about helping to underwrite the Bishop's Radio Hour. Again, that's radio@scd.org.
Hi, this is Laura Lynn, Assistant Director for Lay Formation, and you are listening to the Bishop's Hour with Bob Dunning.
That's me. Thanks, Laura Lynn, for all you do. I appreciate you giving us that wonderful introduction, and we're pleased and honored to welcome in Tom Muser. Tom, good day to you.
Thank you very much, Bob. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you. Looking at this beautiful new edition of the Catholic Herald, cultivating gratitude in parish life, and there's our picture on your ranch, and you're holding some pieces of fruit in your hand, and I'm trying to decide if they're peaches, apricots, small apples, or nectarines.
Well, I think those were nectarines.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Do you raise nectarines?
I think I have 5 nectarine trees.
Oh, wow. Do you guard your orchard?
We live on a hill overlooking Placerville.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not real accessible, so I don't have to guard it.
You don't have to guard it.
The only thing I have to guard it from would be the birds and the grandkids.
And yeah, exactly. So do you sell it commercially, or is it just very, very small?
Well, no, I never have sold anything. We have 5 of our 6 children that live in Placerville or in the area.
Oh, wow.
So we're very fortunate in that respect. So we give them whatever they want. And then we also, my wife Jane is very involved in the Mother Teresa Maternity Home.
Mm-hmm.
So we provide fruit there. And if we have extra, we give that to the upper room.
Oh, how wonderful. That's wonderful. Isn't it wonderful to have that kind of bounty that you can share?
Well, I mean, I just love it. I've always loved to grow things, and it was always kind of a difficult thing because of my work at the bank. And now that I'm retired, I have the time, and I really enjoy being out there and spending as much time as I want.
This story in the Catholic Herald titled Grateful for God's Gifts, and you say, and it's off-quoted, when much is given, much is required of us. And you and your wife, Jane, parishioners at St. Patrick there in Placerville, you seem to live that motto.
Well, we certainly try to, and we've tried to ever since we got together. We met in college. We married the week after I graduated from St. Mary's. And ever since we've been together, we've always tried to provide for the church and for other organizations. And in the beginning, of course, we didn't have much, but as things got better financially, we've expanded our giving, and we feel that is not only our responsibility and obligation, but also our privilege.
Well, the thing that I liked about the story, too, was, as you explained, that, you know, shortly after college, you didn't have much, but you still gave.
Yes, you probably saw the story about the envelope.
Yes,
so we always had an envelope for the church, and there was always something in there every week. So when we went to Mass, we always had something to give. And over the years, that's gotten better, and we're blessed that we can do that.
And you went to St. Mary's in Moraga, and your wife went to Dominican in San Rafael?
Correct.
That's a pretty good commute.
At that time, St. Mary's was all male.
Right.
Dominican was all female.
Right.
So it didn't seem that long because chance to get together.
Yeah.
And we had mixers between the schools mm-hmm. to get together. And Jane and I met on a blind date in March of 1964.
Wow. Well, that's a match made in heaven.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Clearly. That's wonderful. And Jane is very involved at the Mother Teresa Maternity Home in Placerville. I believe it started, in 1999? Is that correct?
Yes, 1998.
Yeah.
She and Lucille Mosbacher, who was a parishioner, and I believe she had 14 children.
Wow.
So Jane and Lucille got together. And they founded the maternity home. Some of our parishioners very generously provided funds to remodel the convent that was occupied by nuns when they were there at St. Patrick. And they ended up having six very nice rooms to take in homeless pregnant women.
And was there... When they founded this, was there a need that they perceived, or did they build it and they will come?
Well, I think they always perceived there was a need, and specifically Jane was involved in Right to Life group mm-hmm. in the area, and also an organization called We Care. She visited young mothers at the hospital, and I think through these different organizations, she realized there were too many, actually, women who needed help, that were alone and that were trying to figure out how to have their baby and still care for it after it was born.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, they perceived the need and then tried to answer that need.
Yeah, attended the vocations dinner up at St. Patrick in Placerville 2 or 3 years ago. And just what a beautiful church.
Well, we have a wonderful parish, very active parishioners. A lot of people give their time and talents to help people in the area. So, we're blessed there with being with such a wonderful community of Catholic people and our pastor, Father Hernando Gomez, who is also wonderful.
I remember one of my teenage daughters came with me, and we checked the mask out. The vocations dinner is an annual event, but they move it around the diocese, and it's always a Saturday night dinner. And so we checked the mass schedule, and I believe it was either a 4 p.m. or a 4:30 p.m. And I said, "Oh, we can go to mass before the dinner." And so we're in St. Patrick, and the Knights of Columbus were just outside the door, and it was a summer day, and they were cooking tri-tip, and the smell of the tri-tip came into the church right before communion, and I thought, well, this is a new twist on...
Well, they know how to get people to their dinner.
They sure did, I'll tell you. So yeah, and it was just nice being up there in the hills. Tell us about your career at the bank and how that affected, you know, your philanthropy as well.
Well, I started at El Dorado Savings Bank in 1969.
In Placerville?
In Placerville. Mm-hmm. It was just, the main office was in Placerville. Mm-hmm. We had one branch and about $18 million in assets, which is a very small community bank.
Mm-hmm.
So it was good for me because I got in right at the ground floor. I learned all the different procedures and operations. I did most of things at one time or another. So as the bank grew and got larger, I was able to move up and advance in my career. And, of course, as that happened, my salary increased and we were able to provide for our family, but also had enough funds to support the parish, but also other organizations that both of us thought were worthwhile and needy and could help people.
Wow. So, and you obviously support the church and support things like the Mother Teresa Maternity Home, et cetera, and various church missions, but also community projects as well.
Yes. For instance, the El Dorado Community Boys and Girls Club, I was on the board of directors for many years there, and we support that. And then there are a number of other local community, I'm trying to think of all the different ones. Anyway, we both, the El Dorado Community Foundation, Jane was one of the original board members there, a founding board member, and I served for 6 years on that also, mm-hmm. So we also support that. We have another fund, donor advised fund at the El Dorado Community Foundation, and that's where I got the idea that maybe I could set one up at the Catholic Foundation when I was on the board there.
And how does a donor advised fund work?
Well, you make a donation to set up the fund, and usually that can be a smaller amount, a couple thousand dollars or whatever. And then when you make that donation, it becomes a tax deduction at that point, but you can give the money out of the fund later. Mm-hmm. It could be a year or 2 or 3 years later. So, for instance, when we set up the Muser Family Fund at the Catholic Foundation, we started with a modest amount, and then for the last 10 years, we've been adding to it. And then we didn't give anything for, I think, 5 years. We let it accumulate, and then we started giving annual disbursements.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to, the disbursement, you make a recommendation to the administrator of the fund, which is the Catholic Foundation, and then they approve it. And it's almost automatic, but I guess if you wanted to give something that they thought was inappropriate, especially since they have certain restrictions on where the funds can go, then they might say no. But we've always had agreement with the Catholic Foundation that when we asked to make a distribution from the fund, they always agreed to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then
mm-hmm.
at that time, when you make the distribution, it becomes, when you make the contribution, it's a tax-deductible event. In that year, you make the contribution.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you make the distribution, it is not another taxable event at that point.
Right, right. So what sort of, talk if you would about, the Mother Teresa Maternity Home there, what sort of expenses do they have that people might not be aware of?
Well, it's all run by donations.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no funding, there's no automatic or funding that comes every month from another source.
Right.
I think obviously some comes from the diocese on an annual basis,
mm-hmm.
but it's expensive because they have a director who is college educated,
sure.
and has the ability and the background to deal with these women who have different needs and issues, and then it's staffed 24 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got people there all the time. So it's expensive. The wonderful thing so far is that the community has been behind it.
Yeah.
They have an annual fundraiser dinner, usually in February. This year it'll be remote because of the virus.
Sure.
But this is attended not just by Catholics, but people in the community that realize that this maternity home is doing good for people in need. So it's very gratifying for Jane, since she puts in all this time, to see the community come together,
yeah.
and make sizable donations to keep the maternity home going. And then we have other people that send a check, maybe monthly. It might be a smaller check or a medium or larger, but it touches a lot of people, attorney who was doing. And it just brings out the charity.
I've been to the Bishop Gagos Maternity Home annual dinner for a number of years, and And I've sensed the same thing there, that even though maybe it's a Catholic-dominated group, it really does bring together people in the community who see what great work is being done there. Is your model and their model, are they similar?
I know Jane has talked to the people at Bishop Gallegos Maternity Home, and when they founded the Mother Teresa Maternity Home, they got a lot of good information from them. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not sure if it's exactly the same model or not. I think Bishop Gallegos has more women there, can accommodate more women.
Yeah, it's a little bigger group, yeah.
But I think it's probably the same thing, because what they try to do, they give them a safe place to come,
right?
You know, where they can finish their pregnancy. But at the same time, the women are learning something. You know, they have people come in to teach them. They encourage them to get a local job if they can, you know, if they're still mobile, and earn some money. They do have to pay a certain amount. It's a small amount, but just to show that they're contributing.
Sure.
And then if they complete the program, the maternity home provides funds for them to set up on their own.
Oh, wow. Yeah, boy, that's great stuff. Was there any opposition in the community from officialdom, you know, zoning or anything like that when you first proposed this?
I don't recall anything, and I think I would have if Jane had mentioned it to mm-hmm. me. As I say, it was a convent when we had nuns in the parish teaching religious education. But when they left, then the convent was vacant, and Jane talked to the pastor at that point, Father Sullivan. Mm-hmm. If they could, Jane and Lucille Mosbacher talked to Father Sullivan to see if they could use it. He was very wonderful in helping them. And Father Cantwell, the pastor that followed him,
right,
was extremely supportive of the home and still is. So as far as I know, there is no opposition to it, and there never was any.
Yeah, that's good. That's very good. Yeah. Well, Tom, we are flat out of time, but thank you so much for all you do and for joining us. Thank Jane for us as well. And it's a very inspiring story, and I hope everybody reads about it and it inspires them as well.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tom. God bless.
That's, God bless you.
That's Tom Muser. He and his wife, Jane, up in Placerville at St. Patrick Parish. And there's all those great people up there in the city of Placerville, up in the foothills, up in El Dorado, El Dorado County. So, and a reminder, we have a new cardinal in the United States, Archbishop Wilton Gregory. He's the Archbishop of Washington, D.C., of the Archdiocese of Washington, D.C. Started out in Belleville, Illinois as a bishop. That didn't start out there, but that's where he became. The first time he was a bishop was in Belleville, and was the head of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops during the Dallas Charter for the protection of young people. And a very, very... just as Bishop Soto described him, just a very likable guy, a great sense of humor, a great face for the church. Went from Belleville to becoming the Archbishop of Atlanta, and just in the last year or so became the Archbishop of the Archdiocese of Washington, D.C. Now has been named a cardinal by Pope Francis, and he will at age 72. If you're under the age of 80, you're eligible to vote when and if there is an opening in the papacy, like at the top, like the Pope. You could vote. The College of Cardinals votes everyone who is under the age of 80. And Archbishop Gregory is 72. So a decent chance that he will be voting when they're is an opening, and although we hope Pope Francis has a very long tenure as well. Although when he first came into the papacy, talked about it, well, it may be a very short, but it hasn't been. And so, but that's it's a great honor, and he is African American, and it's a great thing for African Americans in this country and for African American Catholics as well. So we should all say a prayer for Bishop Gregory, and it's a great honor for him and a great honor for the American Church.